content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the A Critic at Large section of the March 3rd, 2025 issue of the New Yorker magazine. The Gilded Age Never Ended. Plutocrats, Anarchists, and What Henry James Grasped About the Romance of Revolution by Adam Gopnik. When, in the 1990s, people decided that we were living in a new Gilded Age, the meaning was plain. The term, borrowed from the 1873 Mark Twain novel of the same name, a mediocre book by a great writer with a memorable title. Like Anthony Trollope's The Way We Live Now, indicated an efflorescence of wealth and display, of overabundance and nouveau riche excess. It referred mostly to the Veblian side of American life, status competition through showy objects, from the cloud-level duplexes of the New York skyline to the Met Gala. Perhaps not enough attention was paid to the original concept, which implied a contrast between the truly golden and the merely gilded. What we didn't anticipate was that our new Gilded Age would become even more like its precursor, not only in the seeming concentration of overwhelming wealth into fewer and fewer hands, but in the gravitation toward a plutocracy. In the Industrial Age, the totemic figures were Frick and Morgan and Rockefeller. In our post-industrial age, they are Bezos, Musk, and Zuckerberg. During that first Gilded Age, if we imagine it running from the 1870s to 1910, a counter cast of characters had a glamorous appeal of their own. These were the anarchists, whose isolated but highly publicized acts of individual retaliation were intended as inspirational, melodramatic theater, rather than as actual revolutionary politics. In these years, anarchists claimed the lives of a French president, an American president, an Italian king, and a Russian czar, and threw bombs at several American tycoons. Whether or not Luigi Mangione's recent alleged murder of a helpless insurance executive on a cold New York morning belongs to this tradition, its effect and effect certainly evoke the past, with the curly-haired, Ivy-educated youth conferring, in the realm of social media, an improbable aura of martyrdom and purpose on what otherwise would have seemed a sordid act. How to make sense of their age and ours, one Gilded Age long gone and one now getting stripped of its shine. Henry James, famous for his timidity, his fastidiousness, his suspicion of anything meretricious or gaudy, might seem an unusual figure to lead this investigation, but he does just that in Peter Brook's new book, Henry James Comes Home, published by the New York Review. Brooks tells the story of James' return to America in 1904 and his observations of the country after his happy childhood in pre-Civil War New York and his sojourns in Paris and London. The study is a companion piece to a volume that Brooks, an emeritus professor at Yale, wrote almost two decades ago, The Wonderful Henry James Goes to Paris. That book sought to understand why James, an abiding Francophile and prescient admirer of French modernism, could not make a home for himself in Paris in the 1870s. Brooks offered, on James' behalf, some finely wrought speculations about the deceptively open nature of Parisian intellectual life, which remains true to this day. This book is not as good as that one, in part because it is more narrowly moralistic, with too much tut-tutting about New York as it was, and in part because, where the Parisian story had to be extracted from letters and novels, this story is one that James himself laid out in a published account of his return, The American Scene. Inevitably, the job is given over more to paraphrase and gloss than to original narrative. We miss James's mature prose, the tension between endless fuss and decisive lucidity, the beautiful Whistlerian fog that somehow lifts just long enough to show us things exactly as they are. Because the fog sometimes turns out to be the actual transmitter of illumination, the clarity rising from within the confusions, any simple summary or attempt to distill objective lessons betrays his mind. James was a racist of a sort. While also an advocate for the writing of W.E.B. Du Bois, he could be an anti-immigrant and vestigially anti-Semitic. His visit to Ellis Island and the Lower East Side is one of the more disagreeable things in all his writings. The, quote, denizens of the New York ghetto, heaped as thick as the splinters on the table of a glass blower, had each, like the fine glass particle, his or her individual share of the whole hard glitter of Israel, end quote. It is easy to become impatient with James, since the beautiful confusions sometimes recede to reveal simple hypocrisies. James, and Brooks after him, raps indignant at the cottages built in Newport by members of the Nouveau regime. He was thinking of Vanderbilt and Whitney. But James rhapsodized about the stately homes of England, which differed mainly in having been built centuries instead of minutes before. He wrote, "Of all the great things that the English have invented and made part of the credit of the national character, the most perfect is the well-appointed, well-administered, well-filled country house." England, not just America, was full of newly ascendant plutocrats, something that James himself acknowledged at the beginning of The Portrait of a Lady, when a lovingly detailed country house turns out to be the recent acquisition of a man with a freshly minted fortune. James had a weakness for new money that bought old houses, rather than new money that built its own. And then James had loved the New York of his childhood, which he beautifully detailed in his memoir, Notes of a Son and Brother. The new New York he saw rising around him was, to his mind, uglier and coarser. But this holds true for everyone in every period, even when the New York we cherished in our youth was roundly condemned in its day as uglier and coarser than any that had ever been before. For those of us who first got to know New York in the movie Taxi Driver, hellscape of the 1970s, the city was also irresistibly full of artistic explosions in neighborhoods like Soho, while the last sweet renaissance of American swing was blooming beautifully in the still cheap supper clubs. Now, with all these things vanished, along with the bookstores and repertory cinemas, the city seems impoverished and disfigured. James remembered 14th Street and Barnum's Museum in its heyday, and could see no point in the new Fifth Avenue. This is a cycle that never ends. Though James never used the term plutocrat, plutocratic America is what he was examining. To what extent were his plutocrats like ours? The Gilded Age plutocrats made their money in steel, Carnegie, oil, Rockefeller, mining, Frick, and railroads, Vanderbilt. But in the main, their business models were not so different from those of their counterparts today. Musk makes most of his money in hard industrial goods, mainly cars and satellites, while losing money on the digital media front. Just as that other car maker, Henry Ford, futilely poured money into his anti-Semitic newspaper, the Dearborn Independent. Bezos, meanwhile, made much of his money by finding new ways for consumers to shop for more goods more efficiently while forcing smaller retailers out of business, exactly like Wanamaker and Woolworth in their day. Yet real differences persist. The typical plutocrat who built the America, and particularly the New York, that James visited was a businessman with almost absolute freedom to act, and his political power was enormous. It is worth recalling that Hitler's constant insult to the democratic governments of Britain and America was that they were simply screens for predatory plutocrats. Yet these men's behavior was tightly circumscribed, at least in appearance. The plutocrats of the first Gilded Age were mostly content to influence from a distance, through intermediaries. for one thing, they were busy and living far away from Washington at a time when that still mattered. For another, discretion had political advantages. When J.P. Morgan met with President Grover Cleveland in 1895 to discuss a deal to supply the government with gold while enriching Morgan's syndicate with government-issued bonds, it was a scandal that contributed to Cleveland's ouster the following year. Bezos and Musk have made a bet that increasing their economic power requires increasing their political power in a fairly direct way. There is another difference between their plutocrats then and ours today. Our plutocrats despise the arts as an emblem of the cautious, encumbering, ancient regime they reject. But James' plutocrats respected art, even if their motive was just to buy their way into the upper classes. And they did this by collecting the old masters, or by opening libraries, or building concert halls. The history of Gilded Age philanthropy is genuinely remarkable. And although it is easy to dismiss Rockefeller's motivation for starting the University of Chicago, or Frick's reason for collecting Bellini as the empty acts of aging villains, arthritis producing altruism, they did ennoble the public realm. It is no accident that our great concert hall is called Carnegie, nor that, stuck in traffic around one of our greatest public spaces, Grand Central Terminal, we halt in front of a statue of Cornelius Vanderbilt. Indeed, to a first approximation, the most notable examples of New York architecture are plutocratic projects from the first Gilded Age or its aftermath, whether the Metropolitan Museum of Art or the first great skyscrapers, most of which are associated with individuals like Woolworth. They are triumphs of the capitalist imagination as much as the Gothic Cathedral is of the Catholic imagination, and no less for it. One need only visit the Met's newly reinstalled American wing to delight in the restored Gilded Age interiors. The Lafarge and Tiffany glass pieces are ineffable objects of delicate beauty. As poetic in their way as the marriage chist that we are asked to admire in the Medici Florence. Plutocrats they may have been, Philistines they were not. Some are too easily forgotten. The Grand Master and Manager of Penn Station, Alexander Cassatt, was among the most interesting men of the time. Brother to the great painter Mary, and one of the first collectors of French Impressionist painting in America. He was both an engineer and an aesthete, combining an appreciation for the less visible work of public good with the unmissable acts of plutocratic ostentation. While building the old Penn Station in the image of the Baths of Caracalla in Rome, he was also responsible for the construction of the railroad tunnels under the Hudson, on which we still depend, as wholly admirable a modern Medici as one can hope to find. Today's plutocrat, on the other hand, sees the cultural elite as part of the burdensome past. One prophetic peculiarity of Donald Trump's rise in New York was his scanting of any philanthropic role. Those who did fill that role, as he felt acutely, had rejected him. Almost uniquely among New York real estate tycoons, he never served on the board of any important cultural institution, at least until he staged a coup at the Kennedy Center. There will be no Trump museums except those devoted to his glory. This turn away from patronage has been gradual, evolutionary, and partial. David Geffen could still play the classic plutocratic part a decade ago, using a fortune that he'd made in entertainment to sustain the permanence of art, while Bezos clearly was on his way to the older role. The purchase of the Washington Post was a classic plutocratic gesture, the billionaire saving an American institution when the new reality caught up with him. Where the plutocrats of the first Gilded Age built the New York we love, our own plutocratic class has scarcely built a monument or public building of beauty. Everyone likes anarchists. When Charlie Chaplin called the Marx Brothers anarchists, it was taken as high praise. insert an anarchist philosopher into a play, and he will walk away with the action. Indeed, in Tom Stoppard's The Coast of Utopia, the anarchist Bakunin, played by Ethan Hawke on Broadway, always upstaged the actual hero of the play, the liberal Herson. Bakunin's character was not merely more Leonin, he was more lovable. The anarchist Emma Goldman's autobiography remains read nearly a century after its first appearance and is one of the golden books of its time. In its novelistic detailing and historic sweep, it's a superior reads. Meanwhile, the memoirs of the humbler Fabian politicians of the day are left to the dry dust of secondhand bookstores. Anarchists were fierce, but somehow funny. In the silent movie era, they were still so much a part of the fabric of American life, or at least of its mythology, that a Billy West comedy centered on the pitching back and forth of anarchist bombs, those bowling balls with lit fuses, and Buster Keaton innocently turned the same kind of bomb into a cigarette lighter in his film Cops. This despite the reality that what the Gilded Age anarchists mostly did was kill people, or try to, and mostly pointlessly. The Haymarket anarchists in Chicago in the 1890s may not all have been directly responsible for the bombs that killed seven policemen on a fateful day, but at least one of them had certainly built the bombs. Leon Czolgosz, who shot President William Kinley in Buffalo, was inspired in part by Emma Goldman, who later wrote in his defense. And Goldman herself, under the crucial influence of the anarchist philosopher Johann Most, who impressed on her the anarchist ideal of propaganda of the deed, worked hard on a plan to kill Frick, sending her lover, Alexander Berkman, off to Pittsburgh with a revolver that he didn't know how to use. Neither Goldman or Berkman knew anyone in the labor unions that were striking against Frick, nor ever asked them if his assassination would be helpful to their cause. It wasn't. It only helped turn popular opinion against the unions. But few remember the organizers who, in the same period, helped build the American Union movement, while Emma Goldman's name still rings. Why is this so? Henry James, once again, explored the allure of anarchy in what may be his finest Gilded Age novel, The Princess Casamassima. This one a major book by a great author with a hard-to-remember title. Published in 1886, it tells the story of a young man, improbably named Hyacinth Robinson, who becomes entangled in an almost love affair with a radical chic aristocrat, the princess of the title. It's notable that the names of the characters in this book about violence and poverty are pure High James. Hyacinth Robinson, Paul Muniment, Christina Light, the princess, Lady Aurora Langrish. These are meant to key us into the fact that this is thoroughly stylized fiction, less a realist novel than an allegory of anarchism and its temptations. Hyacinth has a dark background. His mother has murdered his father and is now in prison, and he has become involved with an anarchist philosopher named Hoffendahl, who has entrusted him with a nebulous plan to assassinate someone important, though Hyacinth isn't sure who. The princess is a philanthropist who has taken a subversive turn and whose purpose is to elevate Hyacinth, whom she flirts with without ever consummating the affair. James is quite tough-minded about the limits of radical chic. To the princess, it's an amusement like any other, Hyacinth's anarchist minder Paul Muniment says dismissively, and we are meant to think he's right. Though the novel is European rather than American in setting, what is remarkable and universal is the connection drawn between the aestheticism of Hyacinth's nature and the magnetism that anarchism holds for him. Much of the novel is taken up by Hyacinth waiting to learn what his mission is while discussing with the princess the necessity of some mission. Hyacinth is drawn to the propaganda of the deed not for any specific purpose, but because it is the fulfillment of the romantic ideal. With Marxism tainted by its aggressive materialism and mere democratic socialism, so mere, anarchism could be imagined as a series of defiant spiritual acts. This is both the contradiction and the appeal of Goldman's memoirs. Famous for her love of dancing and celebration and her rejection of the puritanical side of the Marxist inheritance, she saw no contradiction between that sensuality and random acts of violence directed against the plutocrats. They were both steps in the same dance. Hyacinth has a harder time reconciling his political convictions with his increasing love of beautiful objects, a struggle that culminates in a trip to Venice in which he writes to the princess and bemoans, in a voice improbably like James's own, the contradiction between the beauty he loves and the social creed to which he is committed. Quote, "There are things I shall be too sorry to see you touch, even you with your hands divine. And shall I tell you le fond de ma pensée, as you used to say? I feel myself capable of fighting for them." The monuments and treasures of art, the great palaces and properties, the conquests of learning and taste, the general fabric of civilization as we know it, based, if you will, upon all the despotisms, the cruelties, the exclusions, the monopolies, and the rapacities of the past, but thanks to which, all the same, the world is less impracticable and life more tolerable. End quote. At one level, the novel is a simple saga of a hero's choice, pursuing beauty with the princess in a Venice of the mind, or advancing democracy with the anarchist Muniment through the murder of a stranger. As Muniment instructs him, the assassination will be a purely theatrical action. It will be helpful to the Democrats that, quote, "the classes that keep them down shall be admonished from time to time that they have a very definite and very determined intention of doing so," end quote. The anarchist act is meant as an ornamental admonishment, not as an actual accomplishment. Yet, as the novel moves along and the target chosen for Hyacinth by his anarchist superiors, an unnamed duke, hovers into view, the tangle of motives becomes subtler. We see that the appeal of the anarchist is essentially church-like, akin to the appeal of Catholicism in parallel 19th century novels and lives, rooted in the seductiveness of mystery and of obedience. I was hanging about outside on the steps of the temple, among the loafers and the gossips, but now I have been in the innermost sanctuary, Hyacinth says of his new assignment, and the language is ironic only because it italicizes the original religious spirit so well. Quote, "I have seen the Holy of Holies," end quote. Just as the Catholic Church would hold a perverse appeal to the decadence of the period, eventually drawing in figures as seemingly resistant as Oscar Wilde and Aubrey Beardsley, anarchism held out a similar enchantment at the other end of the political spectrum. Catholicism offers ritual without the tedium of rationality. Anarchism offers revolutionary action against inequality without the taint of materialism, the prospect of personal gain. Anarchist violence is an unworldly action, a protest against fallen existence itself on behalf of the possibility of a beautiful life, rather than an act of practical and therefore mundane consequence. Indeed, the future that Hyacinth thinks will be secured by the anarchist assassinations is comically innocent. A, quote, "vision of societies where, in splendid rooms, with smiles and soft voices, distinguished men, with women who were both proud and gentle, talked of art, literature, and history," end quote. This double nature, both appealing in its sweetness of soul and alarming in its lack of realism about what a program of public murder can achieve, is central to the first Gilded Age's anarchist philosophy. Prince Kropotkin's famous condensation of anarchist beliefs, The Conquest of Bread, is notable today for its techno-optimism. The world has been conquered. Agriculture is amazing. We can do anything now. Quote, the wild plants which yielded naught but acrid berries or uneatable roots have been transformed into succulent vegetables or trees covered with delicious fruits. Thousands of highways and railroads furrow the earth and pierce the mountains, end quote. In the same spirit, the futurist leader Filippo Tommaso Marinetti proclaimed in the first decade of the 20th century, combustion engines and rubber tires are divine. Yet this complacent optimism sat side by side with an apocalyptic appetite for random assassination, the propaganda of the deed. Anarchists offered a perpetually moving Mobius strip, encouraging violent acts and dreaming of abundant dinners, shooting emperors in the back while dancing in their hallways. It is perhaps unsurprising to find that the ideology of anarchism is anarchic. What is surprising is to find it so hardy and contagious. For as our plutocrats become ever more like oligarchs, the philosophy that they embrace is ever more anarchic, with the same mixture of technological utopianism and technological apocalypticism. Today's fascination with destruction and disruption is continuous with the passion of the anarchist. Musk and Mangione bear a striking stylistic resemblance. That combination of rakishness and slightly deranged intensity, the weird self-satisfaction of the crooked smile, the troll in the internet sense, who looks like a terrorist and a boy band member at the same time. How is it that we have plutocrats who play the role of anarchists? Billionaires want to burn down the system that gave them their billions. Even though recently arrived immigrants of the kind who fathered certain startups would have a much harder time creating businesses in systems with no rule of law, where you have to grow up knowing who the bosses are and must pay them bribes from the beginning. The biggest plutocrats of the first Gilded Age, for all their brutalities, played an essentially stabilizing role from behind the scenes. The Cardinal Richelieu role, the wise banker in the background, a role that J.P. Morgan helped perfect. It's a billionaire fantasy of benevolence which runs right through a mythological figure like Bruce Wayne. But Musk, like Trump, is a joker, with the comedy and tragedy masks flipping deliriously around. G.K. Chesterton's great Gilded Age anarchist novel of 1908, The Man Who Was Thursday, defined this doubleness. All the anarchists in a hyper-powerful ring that is the secret engine of Europe are secretly policemen. Or is it that the secret policemen are actually indoctrinated anarchists? Both are true. Chesterton was officially against anarchism, of course, but he was against it in a way that fully accepted its allure. The anarchist hatred of bourgeois materialism is so obviously attractive, so close to the holy, that, though evil, it is irresistible. The appetite for romantic destruction is the flip side of the desire for authoritarian order, and, like the Joker's merry grin and sadistic grimace, one comes right after the other so quickly that they can't be told apart. It is also significant that steampunk, the projection of today's concerns into an imaginary world of late 19th century technology, is the signature surrealism of our time. Then, as now, the real work of reform was done in large part from the ground up, via the creation of unglamorous organizations like local Rotary Clubs, which, as the political scientist Robert Putnam has pointed out, amassed enormous social capital for progressive causes by holding lunches. Meanwhile, the glamorous forces of resistance had largely absorbed the taste of their supposed opposites in the plutocratic caste. They expected the people to admire wild and ostentatious assassinations in the same way that people admired the jewel-studded shirt front of Diamond Jim Brady. Mangione, after all, has been charged with shooting an unarmed stranger in the back, just as James Hyacinth is expected to do. And his public aura is clearly tied to our longing for clear, clean acts of assertion on the part of vaguely defined purposes. What an earlier generation would have celebrated as existential actions, however self-defeating or cruel. This Gilded Age rule, that those who act violently against individuals inherit the mantle of religious martyrdom, while those who act practically to improve a system are dismissed as impotent proceduralists, is visible in the continued appeal of the anarchist imagination. Whatever it is they're accomplishing, they're not just holding lunches, spending our lives captivated by glittery facades and hypnotic spectacles. We dream of the one decisive act that will break us from our chains, even if, in fact, it forges only another link within them. It is a permanent move in our modernity. The First Gilded Age, though its injustices were remedied in part by the progressive movement, was suspended decisively only with the arrival of the Great War. And what is so ominous about that conclusion is that the victims believed, even before it began, that the war would be the ultimate act of creative destruction, a weapon against decadent materialism. People in Britain, France, and Germany were convinced that their countries, along with Europe itself, would be better off if they burned everything down, cleared out the rot, and started over. What they got was suffering and destruction on a scale that still staggers the imagination. At the time, the cleansing fire credo was slowly spreading to America, where the war came later and cost much less, and indeed ushered in something like yet another Gilded Age, the jazz age of the 20s, built on cheap credit and with its own cast of tycoon characters. Throughout that decade, the Secretary of the Treasury was Andrew Mellon, who had assembled a banking empire and who, like his father, was a business partner of Frick's. We have lived within the insulation of the abundance that began then and, despite the depression that soon followed, became a nearly permanent part of the American condition. If the outcome of this new Gilded Age seems likely to be dark, it is perhaps because we have fallen into the trap that Europe fell into in 1914. The belief that by burning down flawed institutions, we can somehow relight a charismatic glow. They didn't, and we won't. The real riddle of the Gilded Age, then and now, is that by objective historical standards, both times were as close to golden as any age can get. The onset of the First Gilded Age corresponds to the greatest uptick in common prosperity in the known history of humankind, while our own age, despite its persistent inequities, is at least as astonishing in the global expansion of prosperity. The common people of 1900 were far wealthier than the common people of 1860. But they were not wrong to sense that they were not participating adequately in the prosperity. As Tocqueville demonstrated long ago, we grade our well-being on a curve. Rising expectations, not mass immiseration, produce revolutionary sentiments. If we feel ourselves victims of injustice and inequality, the practical effect is that we are. To say that America is, across the quintiles, an incredibly wealthy nation and that, on the whole, it has been a well-run nation is almost taboo. We point to obvious deficiencies from one political side or the other. We don't build enough housing in big cities. We don't pay workers enough. Everyone should have health care. Or the family is collapsing. What's become of our subways? Why can't we stop the shoplifters? All of these are problems open to, so to speak, lunchtime solutions. But we dream instead of all-night fires. We want to burn the system down, it seems, in part because it works too well for people we don't like. Every modern age is known by the medievalism it spawns. The first Gilded Age swooned over the melancholy maidens and posy-minded, grail-seeking Galahads of Tennyson's Idylls of the King. And so it is perhaps striking that our own medievalist saga, The Game of Thrones, cycle on television, with its spin-off and its knockoffs, is notably more brutal and less aesthetic than any that has come before. When the most beautiful church in King's Landing blows up, all we see is Queen Cersei celebrating sneeringly with a glass of wine. The same brutal Philistinism of the new Gilded Age as we have come to know it, that of Trumpism, as of the Putinism it admires, is essential to its ideology. There is only power and domination, dragons and destruction, and anything more is a fool's deception. Hierarchies of power are intrinsic to human societies, no doubt. And sometimes the best we can hope for is that those on top become devoted to a higher ideal of education or common welfare or simple beauty. Without that impulse, we live in a truly barren time. Golden is better than gilded, but even gilt, G-I-L-T, is better than iron. Next, from the January 30th, 2017 issue of The New Yorker, Doomsday Prep for the Super Rich by Evan Osnos. Some of the wealthiest people in America, in Silicon Valley, New York, and beyond, are getting ready for the crack-up of civilization. How did a preoccupation with the apocalypse come to flourish in Silicon Valley, a place known to the point of cliché for unstinting confidence in its ability to change the world for the better? The impulses are not as contradictory as they seem. Technology rewards the ability to imagine wildly different futures. Roy Behat, the head of Bloomberg Beta, a San Francisco-based venture capital firm, told me, "When you do that, it's pretty common that you take things ad infinitum, and that leads you to utopias and dystopias," he said. It can inspire radical optimism, such as the cryonics movement, which calls for freezing bodies at death in the hope that science will one day revive them, or bleak scenarios. Tim Chang, the venture capitalist who keeps his bags packed, told me, "My current state of mind is oscillating between optimism and sheer terror." How many wealthy Americans are really making preparations for a catastrophe? It's hard to know exactly. A lot of people don't like to talk about it. Anonymity is priceless, one hedge fund manager told me, declining an interview. Sometimes the topic emerges in unexpected ways. Reid Hoffman, the co-founder of LinkedIn and a prominent investor, recalls telling a friend that he was thinking of visiting New Zealand. "Oh, are you going to get apocalypse insurance?" the friend asked. "I'm like, huh?" Hoffman told me. New Zealand, he discovered, is a favored refuge in the event of cataclysm. Hoffman said, "Saying you're buying a house in New Zealand is kind of a wink, wink, say no more. Once you've done the Masonic handshake, they'll be like, oh, you know I have a broker who sells old ICBM silos and they're nuclear hardened and they kind of look like they would be interesting to live in." I asked Hoffman to estimate what share of fellow Silicon Valley billionaires have acquired some level of apocalypse insurance in the form of a hideaway in the U.S. or abroad. "I would guess 50+%, he said. "But that's parallel with the decision to buy a vacation home. Human motivation is complex, and I think people can say, I now have a safety blanket for this thing that scares me." The fears vary, but many worry that as artificial intelligence takes away a growing share of jobs, there will be a backlash against Silicon Valley, America's second highest concentration of wealth. Southwestern Connecticut is first. "I've heard this theme from a bunch of people," Hoffman said. "Is the country going to turn against the wealthy? Is it going to turn against technological innovation? Is it going to turn into civil disorder?" One measure of a survivalism spread is that some people are starting to speak out against it. Max Levchin, a founder of PayPal and of Affirm, a lending startup, told me, "It's one of the few things about Silicon Valley that I actively dislike. The sense that we are superior giants who move the needle and, even if it's our own failure, must be spared." To Levchin, prepping for survival is a moral miscalculation. He prefers to shut down party conversations on the topic. I typically ask people, "So you're worried about the pitchforks? How much money have you donated to your local homeless shelter?" This connects the most, in my mind, to the realities of the income gap. All the other forms of fear that people bring up are artificial. In his view, this is the time to invest in solutions, not escape. At the moment, we're actually at a relatively benign point of the economy. When the economy heads south, you will have a bunch of people that are in really bad shape. What do we expect then? On the opposite side of the country, similar awkward conversations have been unfolding in some financial circles. Robert H. Duggar worked as a lobbyist for the financial industry before he became a partner at the global hedge fund Tudor Investment Corporation in 1993. After 17 years, he retired to focus on philanthropy and his investments. Anyone who's in this community knows people who are worried that America is heading towards something like the Russian Revolution, he told me recently. To manage that fear, Duggar said, he has seen two very different responses. People know the only real answer is fix the problem, he said. It's a reason most of them give a lot of money to good causes. At the same time, though, they invest in the mechanics of escape. He recalled a dinner in New York City after 9/11 and the bursting of the dot-com bubble. A group of centimillionaires and a couple of billionaires were working through end of America scenarios and talking about what they would do. Most said they'll fire up their planes and take their families to Western ranches or homes in other countries. One of the guests was skeptical, Duggar said. He leaned forward and asked, "Are you taking your pilot's family too? And what about the maintenance guys? If revolutionaries are kicking in doors, how many of the people in your life will you have to take with you?" The questioning continued. In the end, most agreed they could not run. Elite anxiety cuts across political lines. Even financiers who supported Trump for president, hoping that he would cut taxes and regulations, have been unnerved at the ways his insurgent campaign seems to have hastened a collapse of respect for established institutions. Duggar said, "The media is under attack now. They wonder, is the court system next? Do we go from fake news to fake evidence? For people whose existence depends on enforceable contracts, this is life or death." Robert A. Johnson sees his peers' talk of fleeing as a symptom of a deeper crisis. At 59, Johnson has tousled silver hair and a soft-spoken, avuncular composure. He earned degrees in electrical engineering and economics at MIT, got a PhD in economics at Princeton, and worked on Capitol Hill before entering finance. He became a managing director at the hedge fund Soros Fund Management. In 2009, after the onset of the financial crisis, he was named head of a think tank, the Institute for New Economic Thinking. When I visited Johnson not long ago at his office on Park Avenue South, he described himself as an accidental student of civic anxiety. He grew up outside Detroit in Grosse Pointe Park, the son of a doctor, and he watched his father's generation experience the fracturing of Detroit. "What I'm seeing now in New York City is sort of like old music coming back," he said. More and more were saying, "You've got to have a private plane. You have to assure that the pilot's family will be taken care of, too. They have to be on the plane." By January 2015, Johnson was sounding the alarm. The tensions produced by acute income inequality were becoming so pronounced that some of the world's wealthiest people were taking steps to protect themselves. At the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Johnson told the audience, "I know hedge fund managers all over the world who are buying airstrips and farms in places like New Zealand because they think they need a getaway." Johnson wishes that the wealthy would adopt a greater spirit of stewardship, an openness to policy change that could include, for instance, a more aggressive tax on inheritance. 25 hedge fund managers make more money than all of the kindergarten teachers in America combined, he said. Being one of those 25 doesn't feel good. I think they've developed a heightened sensitivity. The gap is widening further. In December, the National Bureau of Economic Research published a new analysis by the economists Thomas Piketty, Emmanuel Saez, and Gabriel Zuckerman, which found that half of American adults have been completely shut off from economic growth since the 1970s. Approximately 117 million people earn, on average, the same income that they did in 1980, while the typical income for the top 1% has nearly tripled. That gap is comparable to the gap between average incomes in the U.S. and the Democratic Republic of Congo, the authors wrote. Johnson said, if we had a more equal distribution of income and much more money and energy going into public school systems, parks and recreation, the arts and healthcare, it could take an awful lot of sting out of society. We've largely dismantled those things. As public institutions deteriorate, elite anxiety has emerged as a gauge of our national predicament. Why do people who are envied for being so powerful appear to be so afraid? Johnson asked. What does that really tell us about our system? He added, it's a very odd thing. You're basically seeing that the people who've been the best at reading the tea leaves, the ones with the most resources, because that's how they made their money, are now the ones most preparing to pull the ripcord and jump out of the plane. On a cool evening in early November, I rented a car in Wichita, Kansas, and drove north from the city through slanting sunlight across the suburbs and out beyond the last shopping center where the horizon settles into the farmland. After a couple of hours, just before the town of Concordia, I headed west down a dirt track flanked by corn and soybean fields, winding through darkness until my lights settled on a large steel gate. A guard, dressed in camouflage, held a semi-automatic rifle. He ushered me through, and in the darkness I could see the outline of a vast concrete dome with a metal blast door partly ajar. I was greeted by Larry Hall, the CEO of the Survival Condo Project, a 15-story luxury apartment complex built in an underground Atlas missile silo. The facility housed a nuclear warhead from 1961 to 1965 when it was decommissioned. At a site conceived for the Soviet nuclear threat, Hall has erected a defense against the fears of a new era. It's true relaxation for the ultra-wealthy, he said. They can come out here. They know there are armed guards outside. The kids can run around. In 2008, Hall paid $300,000 for the silo and finished construction in December 2012 at a cost of nearly $20 million. He created 12 private apartments. Full floor units were advertised at $3 million. A half floor was half the price. He has sold every unit except one for himself. Some survivalists disparage Hall for creating an exclusive refuge for the wealthy and have threatened to seize his bunker in a crisis. Hall waved away this possibility when I raised it with him over dinner. Oh, you can send all the bullets you want into this place. If necessary, his guards would return fire, he said. We've got a sniper post. Recently, I spoke on the phone with Tyler Allen, a real estate developer in Lake Mary, Florida, who told me that he paid $3 million for one of Hall's condos. Allen said he worries that America faces a future of social conflict and government efforts to deceive the public. When I asked how friends usually respond to his ideas, he said, the natural reaction that you get most of the time is for them to laugh because it scares them. But he added, my credibility has gone through the roof. 10 years ago, this just seemed crazy that all this was going to happen, the social unrest and cultural divide in the country, the race baiting and the hate mongering. I asked how he planned to get to Kansas from Florida in a crisis. If a dirty bomb goes off in Miami, everybody's going to go in their house and congregate in bars, just glued to the TV. Well, you've got 48 hours to get the hell out of there. Allen told me that, in his view, taking precautions is unfairly stigmatized. They don't put tinfoil on your head if you're the president and you go to Camp David, he said. But they do put tinfoil on your head if you have the means and you take steps to protect your family should a problem occur. Before I headed back to Wichita, we stopped at Hall's latest project, a second underground complex in a silo 25 miles wide. As we pulled up, a crane loomed overhead, hoisting debris from deep below the surface. The complex will contain three times the living space of the original, in part because the garage will be moved to a separate structure. Among other additions, it will have a bowling alley and LED windows as large as French doors to create a feeling of openness. Hall said that he was working on private bunkers for clients in Idaho and Texas, and that two technology companies had asked him to design a secure facility for their data center and a safe haven for their key personnel if something were to happen. To accommodate demand, he has paid for the possibility to buy four more silos. Fear of disaster is healthy if it spurs action to prevent it, but elite survivalism is not a step toward prevention. It is an act of withdrawal. Philanthropy in America is still three times as large as a share of GDP as philanthropy in the next closest country, the United Kingdom. But it is now accompanied by a gesture of surrender, a quiet disinvestment by some of America's most successful and powerful people. Faced with evidence of frailty in the American project, in the institutions and norms from which they have benefited, some are permitting themselves to imagine failure. It is a gilded despair. As Steve Huffman, the CEO of Reddit, observed, our technologies have made us more alert to risk, but have also made us more panicky. They facilitate the tribal temptation to cocoon, to seclude ourselves from opponents, and to fortify ourselves against our fears instead of attacking the sources of them. The technology investor, Justin Kahn, recalled a recent phone call from a friend at a hedge fund. He was telling me we should buy land in New Zealand as a backup. He's like, what's the percentage chance that Trump is actually a fascist dictator? Maybe it's low, but the expected value of having an escape hatch is pretty high. There are other ways to absorb the anxieties of our time. If I had $1 billion, I wouldn't buy a bunker, Eli Kaplan, the CEO of the digital health startup NeuroTrack, told me. I would reinvest in civil society and civil innovation. My view is you figure out even smarter ways to make sure that something terrible doesn't happen. That view is, in the end, an article of faith, a conviction that even degraded political institutions are the best instruments of common will, the tools for fashioning and sustaining our fragile consensus. Believing that is a choice. I called a Silicon Valley sage, Stuart Brand, the author and entrepreneur whom Steve Jobs credited as an inspiration. In the 60s and 70s, Brand's Whole Earth catalog attracted a cult following with its mixture of hippie and techie advice. Brand told me that he explored survivalism in the 70s, but not for long. Generally, I find the idea that, oh my God, the world's all going to fall apart, strange, he said. At 77, living on a tugboat in Sausalito, Brand is less impressed by signs of fragility than by examples of resilience. He sees risks in escapism. As Americans withdraw into smaller circles of experience, we jeopardize the larger circle of empathy, he said, the search for solutions to shared problems. The easy question is, how do I protect me and mine? The more interesting question is, what if civilization actually manages continuity as well as it has managed it for the past few centuries? What do we do if it just keeps on chugging? After a few days in New Zealand, I could see why one might choose to avoid either question. Under a cerulean blue sky one morning in Auckland, I boarded a helicopter beside a 38-year-old American named Jim Rorstaff. After college in Michigan, Rorstaff worked as a golf pro and then in the marketing of luxury golf clubs and property. Upbeat and confident with shiny blue eyes, he moved to New Zealand 2.5 years ago with his wife and two children to sell property to high-net-worth individuals who want to get far away from all the issues of the world, he said. Rorstaff, who owns Legacy Partners, a boutique brokerage, wanted me to see Tara Iti, a new luxury housing development and golf club that appeals mostly to Americans. The new luxury community will have 3,000 acres of dunes and forest land and 7 miles of coastland for just 125 homes. As we toured the site in a Land Rover, he emphasized the seclusion. From the outside, you won't see anything. That's better for the public and better for us, for privacy. As we neared the sea, Worstoff parked the Land Rover and climbed out. In his loafers, he marched over the dunes and led me down into the sand until we reached a stretch of beach that extended to the horizon without a soul in sight. Waves roared ashore. He spread his arms, turned, and laughed. "We think it's the place to be in the future," he said. For the first time in weeks, months even, I wasn't thinking about Trump, or much of anything. This article was edited for length. Next, a poem from the March 10th, 2025 issue, "What Am I Afraid Of?" by Sasha Debevic McKinney. The silence, the thoughts that come with it, the sinking suspicion that something more is wrong with me than anyone knows, including myself, including the doctor who hooked me up to the EKG machine and said that though my heartbeat was irregular, the irregularity was normal. It was nothing to worry about. The doctor told me there are two kinds of people, unhealthy people who refuse to get help, and healthy people who always think they're dying. Nobody's in between. But I've met so many kinds of people, the people who stretch before they get out of bed, the people who walk through life unstretched, people who think their body is a house, and people who don't think of their body at all, people who peel their carrots, people who don't, people who stand on the roof and let the wind make them cry, people who are afraid to cry, people who step on all the leaves on the sidewalk, people who look straight ahead. There are people who are not like me. They don't know the names of all the different apples. Once when I was cashiering, a woman said to me, "Wow, you really know your kale." And once at the butcher shop, a man said to his dog, "That's the nice lady who smells like meat." I'm afraid I don't know what kind of person I am. I thought I would get a chance to do my life over in all the ways anyone could think of. Dying would be like changing the channel. I hate that you can't hold on to anything. I was washing an apple, and then I was coring it, and then it was cut. And that was weeks ago. It was a Honeycrisp, and it lived up to its name. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure to listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.